You are listening to the Cycling Podcast in association with Rafa, celebrating the sport and producing the finest cycling clothing since 2004. Today, we're in Cherbourg, Octeville.
Hello, my name is Richard Moore. We are at the Tour de France and I'm joined by Lionel Burney.
Good evening, Richard.
And making his first appearance this year, hopefully the first of many, Francois Thomazeau from Le Figaro.
Hi, guys. How are you doing?
Very well, Francois. How are you? Welcome back.
Well, I'm shivering, you know. It's pretty cold here in France. It feels a little bit like this remote place known as Britain.
Oh, the first one.
Oh, dear.
Okay, all right. Enough of that. We'll see if you're laughing tomorrow after tonight's match against Iceland.
We'll see.
And after we've just wrecked the whole of Europe by sort of stampeding through it like a bull in a china shop.
Anyway, before we must say thank you to our sponsors, Rafa, who are sponsoring us at the Tour de France. And for the rest of the year, thank you to them. Where are we, Lionel?
We're at a horse racing course in Cherbourg, or just outside the port of Cherbourg. We're just a little bit inland, aren't we? I mean, it's not exactly Royal Ascot, I have to say, here. Is this an important horse racing venue or quite a small one, Francois?
There are quite a few horse racing venues in Normandy. It's a horse breeding area. So you've got horse racing tracks almost all over the place in this area. But I never heard really Cherbourg, mentioned as a major horse racing track. Maybe I'm wrong, but no, I don't think so. By the look of it, I don't think it is. It might well be a trotting place, actually. I'm pretty sure it is. If you look at the, it's probably trotters,
Well, it's at the top of the hill, isn't it? The Côte de la Glacerie. It's called the Hippodrome de la Glacerie here, isn't it? I mean, it's been a chilly, drizzly day here, but it didn't rain on the riders much today,
not
did it?
Much,
they got away with
much.
It, I think.
Tell us, though, Lionel, the tale of the attack.
Okay, stage two, Saint-Lô to Cherbourg, 183 kilometres with a short, sharp climb of the third category Côte de la Glacerie, very close to the finish. Once again, Bora Argon 18 had two men up the road. The King of the Mountain and Pedaleur de Charme, Paul Voss, was joined by his teammate Benedetti, Trek Segafredo's Jasper Stuyven and Norway's Vegard Brenn of Fortuneo Vital Concept with the other two riders in that four-man break. They built a nice lead before Dimension Data started to bring it in. I'm not sure why they chased quite so hard, knowing that there was a hill at the finish that Mark Cavendish was unlikely to defend his yellow jersey on. There was a crash around the midway point in the stage with Alberto Contador hitting the floor for the second day in a row. Benedetti dropped out of the lead group with around 25 kilometres to go, and the last three riders worked really well together, and the gap was still more than 2 minutes with 10 kilometres to go on an uncategorised climb, which caught us a bit by surprise and perhaps caught the riders by surprise. They looked like they'd run out of steam, but then Stuyven accelerated hard and got a gap on his own. He was still clear at the bottom of the last hill, but was eventually caught with 500 metres to go, and then it was a bit like the finish Flesh Will Own, at least in the sense that the riders who were at the front were the sort of riders you see at that Belgian classic. Peter Sagan won. He won ahead of Julian Alaphilippe, Alejandro Valverde and Dan Martin. Have to mention the work done by Tinkoff's Roman Kreuziger for Sagan on the final climb. The big GC news, other than Alberto Contador losing 48 seconds, was that there was a late disaster for BMC's Richie Port. He punctured on a fast sweeping downhill with about 4 kilometres to go and lost 1 minute 45. Those two weren't the only riders to lose a bit of time. Vincenzo Nibali and Thibaut Pinot gave away 11 seconds. Geraint Thomas lost 24. Ilnur Zakarin lost 41. Just a mention for Michael Moorcock and Sam Bennett, who both finished a long way down, almost a quarter of an hour and over a quarter of an hour, and they looked in a real state when they crossed the line. So the state of play today, Peter Sagan's in yellow at the Tour for the first time. He's also got the green jersey, which will be worn by Mark Cavendish. Jasper Stuyven is in the polka dots, and Julian Alaphilippe is in white.
So I think in part one we're going to talk about the stage. Part two, Pedaleur de Charme with somebody you mentioned there featuring in that, perhaps. And in part three, we're going to look at a bit more at these overall contenders and what happened with them. We've got interviews with with Paul Voss, with Dan Martin, with Tommy Altislachter, with Sean Yates on Alberto Contador, with Richie Port.
Goodness me. I mean, we'll be here. We're going to miss the France game. Sorry, Francois.
Sorry about that. But it's... and the Free Boss file. How could I forget? We've got the Free Boss file. It's the second installment. So Peter Sagan, he won the stage. It's a while since he's even won a stage. I mean, that was the sort of stage he won a lot of in 2012, wasn't it? And always with a very colourful, exuberant celebration. And there wasn't one today.
Well, because he pretended he was racing for third place. But it looks very strange.
That's obviously the secret, isn't it?
Yeah, well, maybe that's the way to do it, you know. Probably he hired now Kreuziger to tell him that, you know, we're sprinting for third place and that's how it goes. Now, I mean, he said at the finish, and he repeated many times, that he really thought there were still two guys in the front. So why did he sprint the way he did, and why did he...
Oh, so do you not believe him?
No, I don't believe it at all. Because, I mean, why, if there were actually two guys in the front, why would have Kreuziger done such a hard work in the last, you know, steep part of the climb just for third place? I can't believe that. I don't think, you know, you waste Kreuziger's force and
especially when Contador's slipping out the back at the same time.
Exactly. So to me, this is bullshit. But, I mean, this is bullshit the Sagan way. That is, we like the way, you know, he bullshits us and... he did it again. He probably bullshitted his rivals.
Sorry,
as well.
Sorry about the swearing, iTunes.
No, are you okay? You know, I'm French, so it's you know.
It sounds suave and sophisticated.
Exactly. I don't know what I'm doing. I don't know what I'm saying. But no, it's maybe because we're on a horse racing track, you know, and it smells a little bit of the word.
I took him at his word. Maybe I'm just more naive, you know. You've been around a lot longer than me, Francois.
Did it really look like he was sprinting for third place?
Sagan, he is obviously going for green jersey as well, so there are valuable points in the line for third place. I also thought at one point that he kind of lost it. Alaphilippe looked like he was going to get it. Sagan dropped back a bit, and then he came again. But I wondered, it was almost like an
sprinting
afterthought.
For third place, you beat Alaphilippe, who's very gifted in this kind of races, and you beat Valverde to third place, and Dan Martin easily. So, you know, you just make a second rate effort, and you beat these guys. No, I really can't believe that.
I'm with Francois here.
Really?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, like you say, I mean, with Kreuziger doing all of that work, Contador going out the back, they would have seen guys up the road. I mean, it wasn't dead straight, but they would have seen the motorbike, certainly, or they would have seen some sign that there was something up the road. And unless Sagan was...
Well, let's hear from one of the protagonist animators in the final stages, Tommy Altislachter, on the climb. Well, it's a really vicious attack. What came from quite far back, rode extremely well, and really did a lot of damage, strung them out. You know, probably there were guys, you know, Pino, Nibali, perhaps that was the moment they slipped out. Let's hear from Tommy Altislachter, who Lionel spoke to at the finish.
A very impressive performance in the final there, but not quite enough to hold off the stampeding peloton.
No, I have to say the effort was good, but I think it was a little bit too far from the finish. And you need quite a lot of luck with that, but... Yeah, I think it was more or less my only chance to do something because it opened up, and just at that moment I went, and maybe if you wait it never opens up and you can't pass, so yeah, it's a pity it doesn't get a result, but I'm satisfied with the leg so far.
Was there a sense in the bunch that Jasper Stuyven might stay away? I mean, it was looking really good.
Yeah, to be honest, I really thought the last 10k, when he had more than 1.5 minute maybe, that he would probably gonna make it, but yeah, then you see how strong the bunch is in the Tour de France, and yeah, it's ridiculous.
It all worked out okay for Pierre Rolland because he was up there at the front, I believe, as he came over the line. What was the plan today? Were you given a bit of leeway to try something if you felt good?
Yeah, that was more or less the plan. We number one was to bring him safe to the finish without any time gaps, and then the second one was to go with me to do a result, and we didn't succeed in that, but the rest was going fine.
And lastly, do you have your eyes on another stage later this week, maybe?
I will have a look in the book when I get into the bus, day by day.
I was impressed with Slagter. It reminded me of his performance at Paris-Nice a couple of years ago, and I thought from there he'd kick on, and this is the ideal sort of finish for him. There's another couple in later in the week, I think, that might suit him just as well. But it was interesting him having that little bit of leeway when Pierre Roland is presumably aiming for a high overall position.
And rode extremely well today
Well,
he was
12th
today, which is an extremely good performance from him. Let's also hear from Dan Martin. I spoke to Dan Martin at the finish. He was fourth, very, very chipper at the finish, laughing and joking with Marcel Kittel. We'll hear in the interview why that was. Here's Dan Martin. Fourth on the stage, Peter Sagan didn't realise he was sprinting for the win. I take it you knew that the win was at stake there.
Yeah, we got told on the radio the track guy was coming back, and of course I saw him. But it was just a strange stage because obviously nobody, a bit of poker going on, nobody really wanted to chase for the stage, use their energy, and when you've got two of the favourites for the stage, you've got GC riders, I guess that's what happens, you know. So, but yeah, we didn't really know, it was a kind of climb that on paper didn't really suit me and Julian, but obviously if it goes full gas up any climb, it's going to be hard, so that's what happened. We went so hard up it that it took the legs off a lot of guys, and yeah, I think we had the headwind there. Julian maybe misjudged it. It looked, it was like a slow motion race from where I was sitting. It was Julian just misjudged the finish, like the headwind and the line, and yeah, unfortunately Sagan just got over him, you know.
How did you feel you're obviously strong to be up there, and as you say it was very fast, so there was a real selection there. How were you actually feeling?
Yeah, I feel really good. I mean, I tried to stay as relaxed as possible all day, and obviously there was a lot of stress in the tour and everybody's fighting for position all day, but I tried to treat today like a one day race and just try and aim for the victory rather than thinking of the GC. And so I think I saved a lot of energy during the stage by not really being involved in the fight for position and kind of trying to relax as much as possible, being at the front but not using any energy just to make up those extra, like, so it's, yeah, I mean, and Marcel did a great, Marcel moved me to the front with 10k to go, and that shows a true team there, you know.
How did he, what, just take you through the peloton or give you a push or what happened?
Yeah, it was like one line. He just gave me a really, really, like, moved me up about 100 places in one slingshot, you know, just like, just freaking rode as hard as he could and moved me on his wheel. And yeah, I mean, it kind of sums up this team, is there?
What strikes me, seeing Dan Martin and Julian Alaphilippe both up there, seeing Kreuziger and Sagan working so well together, and even seeing Bora Argon put two riders in the brakes 2 days running, that's no accident. Teams are using their brains quite well to work in tandem or work in small groups. There's signs that there's a lot more organisation going on.
I think
on
the sport has changed enormously.
Really,
and
has,
we'll hear
yeah.
later from Rolf Aldag talking about sprint trains and so on, just how much it's changed even in the last decade or less than a decade. But Julian Alaphilippe was highly fancied for today, Francois. He is obviously a hugely exciting talent. We had your countryman Seb Piquet on the other day, and he was mm-hmm. tipping Alaphilippe for this stage. He was disappointed, I think, wasn't he, not to win?
Oh yeah, he was really. I mean, he said I must be satisfied with that. He said, the man who beat me is had a rainbow jersey on his back, so I can't be I can't be disappointed. But it his face said exactly the opposite. You could really tell that it really marked that stage down as the one he wanted to win, and he was, that's great, to see a guy who's 22, who's so gifted, so from his first pro year, he was up there with the best, and no complex at all. It's also something new that young riders that don't have that sort of respect, for classics, for their elders. And Alaphilippe, he shot to almost instant fame last season in the Arden Classics, and this guy really, I wrote it in my we all write previews on the ahead of the race, and there's a very, very interesting French narration as we know. And the good thing about Alaphilippe is we really don't know where it stands. I mean, okay, he's a great rider for classics, for Flèche Wallonne type classic, but can he do any better? I mean, he won the Tour of California twice, was sixth in the Dauphiné. So what are his actual limits? What sort of a rider is he? We don't know.
And what sort of character is he, Francois? Because he spent some time as an amateur with the Armée de Terre team, mm-hmm. the French army team. His younger brother, Brian Alaphilippe, is in that team. I was at Trobro-Leon in April and chatted to Jimmy Casper, who won a tour stage, I think, in 2006 mm-hmm. in Strasbourg. He's the only member of that whole organisation that isn't a soldier. He's a civilian. But he was saying how easy it is to manage that group because they've got a sort of ingrained discipline. So is that something that Julian Alaphilippe has also got?
It is very disciplined, but in the same time, it's very straightforward. Like, you know, sometimes when rookies, you know, appear on the pro circuit, that's the kind of shyness or they're a little bit reserved. And Alaphilippe has always been very straightforward, you know, very ambitious, very, a little bit military, you know, like how the soldiers do talk when they go straight to the point, man. And Alaphilippe is a little bit like that, no-nonsense type of guy. He's not maybe as exuberant as other guys, or he's not as probably as funny and smiling like as Warren Barguil or other guys. But, you know, he really... There is something in the way he talks of the old French champions, simple, straightforward, very ambitious, and straight to the point. So we're not used to this kind of guy.
He's not a whimsical flaneur, to quote Daniel Freeboot. I think he used that expression for Warren Barguil, a whimsical flaneur.
He could be a pédaleur de charme, but he's not that type of rider. He's much more
not a pédaleur de charme. No. Are we ruling him out already? speaking of Daniel Freeb, let's hear the installment two of the Freeboss file. Over to you, Daniel.
Bonsoir, chaps. I still haven't really seen you, have I? My long-lost podcasting companion. That is a bit of a lie. I did spot Lionel today about 50 metres away. He was busy interviewing Charlie Wigelius, the Cannondale director sportif. He'd adopted the kind of posture that he usually adopts when he's within ordering distance of his next local speciality, so it's best not to disturb him at those moments. No doubt we'll catch up probably tomorrow morning. I also saw the Buffalo Richard Moore charging around somewhere around the finish this evening. Again, too far away, unfortunately, for me to stop, but again, I'll catch up with Rich later. I'll give him a call just in case he's feeling lonely, neglected. Anyway, yesterday my day really revolved around Mark Cavendish. It did again today. I saw him at the start this morning. He was obviously delighted. I think he was a bit peeved last night when someone stole his helmet in the press conference, or after the press conference he couldn't locate his helmet, but he was in better mood this morning, as you'd expect. He had the yellow jersey, and he was pretty philosophical at the finish as well. He really didn't expect to keep the yellow jersey, probably lost a bit more time than he thought he might, and has probably relinquished all chances of regaining the yellow jersey over the next few days thanks to time bonuses. But he was happy enough, I think, this evening. It was one day in paradise, really, in the yellow jersey. And another common theme from yesterday I was standing next to Mark Cavendish's agent when he came over the line triumphantly. And today I found myself in very close proximity to Peter Sagan's agent, Giovanni Lombardi, when Sagan came over the line triumphant. And Giovanni was actually at the Dimension Data bus this morning. He doesn't have any riders who ride for Dimension Data, but he simply wanted to go on the bus to congratulate Mark Cavendish. He was also sharing the details of a bit of a standoff that has developed with Alexander Vinokourov, the Astana team manager. I think most people know that they have been in negotiations. So there's certainly been talks about Peter Sagan moving to Astana, which seem to have completely broken down. Giovanni confirmed that he has not spoken to Vinokourov, the Astana manager, for 2 or 3 weeks. And he said the onus is on Vinokourov to contact him again. But we also suspect that the deal to take Sagan probably to what is currently Bora Argon 18 might well be done. Just on Sagan's stage win, what really impressed me today was just how cool-headed he was in the finale. We've almost lampooned him in the past, his tactical inability, his tactical incompetence. He has found all sorts of innovative methods of losing stages when it looked like he should have won them. Today, he showed that he has learned a few things. He found himself on the front in the wind at, I think, about 400 or 500 metres to go, maybe slightly closer to the line. And then he took his foot off the gas, pulled back, and got back in the wheels only to sprint again. And that was really the crucial move, the crucial tactical move that allowed him to win and take the first yellow jersey of his career. So Sagan goes from strength to strength. He's already the most entertaining, flamboyant showman we've got in the sport. And I think any victory for Sagan is usually a good day for cycling. So that's my, what are you calling it? Free boss file? Have I got music yet? Have I got my jingle?
Eurosport, the home of cycling.
And now, Pedaleur du Charme.
Thank you very much to Eurosport, who, along with Rafa, are sponsoring the cycling podcast. And Eurosport specifically are sponsoring our daily Pedaleur du Charme award. Before we get on to that, we've got a kind of double header today. We should just mention the free boss file, which he seems to be using as a bit of an excuse to have a pop at us. We'll have to get our revenge somehow.
Extraordinary. I mean, there's no right of reply. Or maybe there is.
Well, I think there is. This is it.
We haven't got time.
We haven't got time. No, it's already a packed episode. If we're going to lay into free boss, let's do it. Let's keep that for a kilometre zero or something, which starts tomorrow, incidentally, kilometre zero. So Monday to Friday in the mornings, kilometre zero. Pedaleur du Charme. Now, there was a lot of support yesterday for Paul Voss, and he won it not on the basis of him being a friend of the podcast. And in fact, he tweeted on Saturday night after the stage that he was listening to the podcast and heard himself being awarded Pedaleur du Charme, which put a smile on his face.
Mm. I wonder what he thought when you nearly tried to take it away from him, Richard.
Yeah, I went and saw him this morning, and we glossed over that, actually. didn't dwell on that. But anyway, I went to see him this morning, gave him his T-shirt, and here's what he had to say.
Paul, must feel very nice to pull on this non-team jersey.
Yeah, it's a nice feeling. Yeah, it's like nice material as well. So
you've been a professional for a long time, and you know, you've been knocking at the door for something like this. I mean, it must be, to be at the biggest race in the world and being one of the jerseys, it must be an incredible feeling.
Yeah, it's nice. It's a kind of reward. Like, the last 4 years I worked quite a lot on this team, and so it's nice to give myself a bit of a reward. And even if it's made for just 1 or 2 days, but it's a nice feeling.
Was it the plan yesterday? Was it a stage you looked at and thought there's an opportunity here?
No, I didn't look at it and I didn't thought about it, but yeah, I got in the meeting told that I have to go for the breakaway, and then yeah, I just made the best out of it.
Did the news about the team on the eve of the tour, you must have known about that for a while, but did that give you a little boost as well?
It didn't give me an extra push. I mean, I'm here to show myself as well, so I'm still up for a contract, so of course, and today, or yesterday was a perfect day to do that, yeah.
Mm. And of course, the more important jersey that you collect today is this one I've got in my hand here.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. I was listening last night to the podcast, and I was like really smiling. Because when you said, like, I'm a friend of the podcast, and then the others didn't believe it, so I'm actually one there.
Yeah, I know, so you're a paid-up member of the podcast, a friend of the podcast.
Yeah, so yeah, no, it's nice to get it, yeah.
How do you find time on the Tour de France to listen to the podcast as well?
I don't know, I'm just doing before I go to bed, like, well, I'll do stretching, or I don't want to watch TV, so
you've
I'm...
You've got better things to do.
No, I'm just relaxing and then just listening to podcasts. It's sometimes quite interesting and some bits to laugh, so I definitely enjoy it, yeah.
Excellent, well, congratulations.
Well, I mean, is there some kind of record for somebody who has held the Pedaleur du Charme jersey from start to finish in a Grand Tour? Because
not since Eddy Merckx.
Well, exactly. I mean, Paul Voss on the attack again, didn't manage to keep hold of his King of the Mountain jersey because Stuyven was just a bit too hot for him on those early climbs, but another strong day out for him.
Yeah, he did say he was going to wear his Pedaleur du Charme t-shirt under the polka dot jersey. I can confirm that he didn't, but I'm sure he will. He wanted to keep it nice, wasn't he? He'll be wearing it tonight, I'm sure. So that another very strong showing from him today. There were other nominations today for Pedaleur du Charme. Tommy Vogtler for being on bottle duty for his teammates. I think he caught a few people's eyes for his charming pedaling while collecting bottles.
Mm-hmm. I think you know what I heard. I mean, it's one of those rumors you like to hear,
like,
because
the sound of this.
Because they, yeah, well, maybe you're the same. You know, he lost time yesterday, he lost time again today. I mean, he's always ridden at the back, but the apparently the idea is that he's going to lose as much time as he can so that he can go on a breakaway on his own and nobody will chase him because he won't be any danger for the overall. So it's a new tactic.
So which deliberately losing
time. Yeah, apparently. So it's a new strategy. You lose as much time as you can in the first, like, 10 stages, and in the 11th, you know, you are with a 1 hour deficit, you can go for it.
Maybe that's what Alberto Contador is doing as well.
Who knows? Who knows?
I don't know. Anyway, there are a lot of nominations. Jasper Stuyven was a nomination just because he is a very stylish, elegant, classy-looking bike rider. He won Kern of Brussels Kern this year with a similar kind of attack where the peloton just misjudged it and he stayed away and won it. But ultimately, our Pedaleur de Charme for today is somebody who was captured on TV on two occasions pushing two of the crash victims from the first day, not teammates, but Sam Bennett, the Irishman, and Michael Morkov, the Dane. And that was a great bit of sportsmanship by Greg Henderson. So I went and spoke to him after the stage and told him that I'd be looking for him in the morning with a Pedaleur de Charme t-shirt. Here is what Greg Henderson had to say.
Oh, I know what it's like, mate. Felt sorry for them going out the back when, you know, you ate yesterday in a big bunch sprint. I don't know exactly the feeling. They're not going out the back because they're bad bike riders. They're going out the back because they're injured. So I just thought I'd give them a little helping hand.
Any other sort of good deeds performed today, other riders you help?
Mate, I'm just such a nice person. I help everyone.
Well, Greg, you're definitely our overwhelming nomination today for Pedaleur de Charme. So I'll come and find you tomorrow morning and give you the Pedaleur de Charme t-shirt.
Oh, beautiful. Thank you very much. Much appreciated.
I mean, technically, Richard, helping a rival rider on another team is against the rules
for
of professional cycling.
Sake,
I don't want to pour
if we're going to be sticklers for the rules, in the Dan Martin interview earlier, he did tell us that Marcel Kittel gave him a handsling and moved him up, he said, 100 places. I mean, I know Kittel's a big guy with broad shoulders, but that's a hell of a handsling, isn't it?
It is.
100 places he moved him up. And technically, that's not allowed either, but I mean, Paul Voss listens to the podcast, but I don't think the commissars do, so we'll just keep that one to ourselves. He told us that in confidence. Anyway, two strong Pedaleurs de Charme there.
Yeah, and I mean, Bennett and Morkov, to be honest, they needed all the help they could get because they look in bits.
Poor Sam Bennett.
Because
last year was the same. I mean, last year he battled on. He was Lantern Rouge for quite a while. And, you know, to come again with great form. He rode so well at the Critérium du Dauphiné. He was up there with the best sprinters in the world. Yeah, he'd have come here thinking he had a decent chance of a stage win and maybe even on a day like today. And terrible luck for him. Awful.
Yeah. Yeah, I like Sam Bennett very much because he's a different type of sprinter. You know, he's not like the muscular. He's not a gripe. He's not a gorilla. He's rather lean. He's rather, you know, diminutive, and he has just what we call velocity. You know, and is natural speed. And I like the way he sprints. He's different, and unfortunately unlucky.
We got in trouble a little bit yesterday for not mentioning Dan McClay, who was ninth on the opening stage and, you know, rides for a small team, first time at a race like this, and that was a very, very strong performance from him. We'll catch up with him one day.
Just on Bennett and Morkov, though, the Tour, it strikes me, it's the only event in the world where people will go beyond and beyond their limits to stay in, and they'll hope against hope that the bruises can start to repair. And they will battle on, but it's horrible watching them fall apart, really, when you see up close just how sort of ragged they look. And, you know, even Alberto Contador today, you know, we'll come on and talk about that in the third part, but there's a lot of wishful thinking going on, I think, you know, even this early in the race.
Yep. Let's, before we go on to part three, just hear another little trailer for one of our friend specials. We release 11 friend specials throughout the year. I think we've released 7 so far this year. So every night we're playing a little clip to tempt those of you who are not already friends of the podcast to become a friend of the podcast. And tonight I think we're hearing a little clip from our most recent one, which we released on the eve of the tour. And it was about Operation Puerto, the doping scandal that broke on the eve of the tour 10 years ago.
Friday 30th of June, the eve of the Grand Départ, was to turn into one of the most shocking and dramatic days in the Tour's 103-year history.
The Guardia Civil had seized over 200 bags of blood or plasma.
Puerto just seemed different and bigger and uglier right from the beginning. Jan Ulrich and Ivan Basso came to the Tour de France as the two big favourites to win it, but they're both out before the race has even started.
I actually thought in my naivety that the peloton would have thought, OK, yeah, this is might have taken a lesson from that. Obviously, Puerto exploded and I was like, oh my God, it's going on even more than ever.
Become a friend of the podcast for 2016. For £10, you'll have access to our friends' specials. To sign up, visit www.thecyclingpodcast.com.
You are listening to The Cycling Podcast in association with Rafa. Whoever you are, wherever you ride, whatever the reason, Rafa exists to improve your ride with the finest kit, inspiring stories, and vibrant clubhouses and communities all over the world. See rafa.cc for more information.
Yes, thank you indeed to Rafa, and their support is enabling us to be here and to give you these daily free podcasts. So thank you very much indeed to them. I did mention on yesterday's podcast that they are also covering the race in their own way. If you go on rafa.cc and you'll find a section called More Than a Race, and every day they are posting tour themed stories. Today actually is one with Paul Smith, the designer, on his cycling style icons. We actually have an interview with Paul Smith in one of our Kilometre Zeros coming up as well, so have a look at that. Every day something of interest on rafa.cc, and yeah, thank you very much indeed to them. We're extremely grateful. So the overall contenders, there's a bit of disruption there today. Poor old Alberto Contador off his bike again.
Well, yeah, I mean, I spoke to Sean Yates, the Tinkoff sports director, this morning. His first word, one word answer about how Contador was just seemed to be a little bit of a diversionary tactic, because just as I walked away from speaking to Sean Yates, I saw on Twitter that Contador was quoted as saying he barely slept a wink last night after his crash. So this is Sean Yates hoping for the best, I think, for Alberto Contador. How is Alberto Contador after a night's sleep?
Fine. I mean, obviously not ideal for a good night's sleep, having your back cut up, but yeah, you got through the night. Today's another day, a bit sore. I guess a bit uncertain, you know. Obviously today it will be a tough final where the GC guys will be going full gas. So it's in the back of your mind also, I think, that maybe it's going to be a handicap, but I'm sure he will deal with it.
Once he gets moving, I guess he'll know. But no further information on what the damage was?
No, it's just skin. Obviously, yesterday he finished the stage fine. Just mentally, it's obviously not ideal. Have to deal with that. You know, the weather's not super duper. Get a bit of dirt in it. You know, I need to wash it again. So just inconvenient, really.
They're tough fellas, these skinny little guys, aren't they?
You don't get much tougher than Alberto. But, yeah, as I said, it's not ideal because, yeah, your body, although nothing is broken, it's still an injury which takes strength to repair. Luckily, apart from today's final, it's a little while to the crucial stages, so he will have time to recover, and I'm quite confident that it won't be a big long-term problem.
And really, Sean Yates' fears came true there, because on that final climb, it was just a bit too much for Contador, and he lost touch, and he lost 48 seconds, which is not disastrous, but it's not what you want if you're aiming for the yellow jersey in Paris, is it?
And it shows how much the crash has affected him already, you know, because that Contador, it's a sort of finish that would have suited a fit and informed Contador, wouldn't it? But these crashes really do take their toll.
I think it's a disaster for Alberto, to be honest. I heard what he said in Spanish on the finish line, and it really sounded, you know, like you were talking of wishful thinking a little bit earlier, that he was saying, well, I must keep my morale, I must, you know, I'm still standing. But in the same time, he said, I'm very unhappy about the situation. He said it hurt. He actually crashed on the other side this time. So he said, both my legs are seriously touched. I can't pedal the way I want. It would be more or less okay if tomorrow was not another long, you know, tricky stage. Well, it's all flat, but I mean, that's not exactly what he likes best. And very, very soon we're in the mountain, even if it's not the high mountain, but Lyon is not an easy ride. So on the day when he should have been doing all right, he will still be nursing his injuries. So I'm afraid it's already over for Arbroath.
He's going to win the Vuelta, though, isn't he?
Maybe.
It sets up the Vuelta nicely. Froome versus Contador. And others as well, actually. And Vuelta's looking pretty good. But we're at the Tour de France. You spoke to Richie Porte, who also... He punctured about 4.5 kilometres from the line, which is probably the worst point to puncture, especially on a stage like today, where, you know, teams were really ripping it up at the front.
Well, coming down that sweeping descent, he took a funny line, didn't he? And it was clear he had a problem. And obviously his back wheel was twitching away from him.
Where's Simon Clark when you need him?
Well, exactly. That's what happened in the Giro last year, wasn't it? When Porte was riding for Sky and his good mate Simon Clark riding for another team gave him... some supporting, you know, assistance.
Well, gave him a wheel. Yeah, we're allowed to say that.
Right, but yeah. It was. It's a bit more than a sort of a shove up a hill or a handsling, isn't it? But yeah, there was none of that today. The wheel change from the neutral service was not the best. I mean, the TV pictures
it was
cut
almost
away.
As bad as a BMC wheel change.
But that's the problem with neutral service, isn't it? That the wheels are not, you know, frames are different thicknesses and. You know, they're not always set. Whereas on a team car, they know exactly the equipment is they are ready to be put in the bike.
Yeah, the TV director.
Neutral service is always a bit of a compromise.
The TV director cut away from the pictures of the poor mechanic struggling just to put him out of his misery. I think. I mean, it was going on and on. And Porte, to his very great credit. As we've seen before, I mean, I think, remember Geraint Thomas when he punctured when he was just about to win the Commonwealth Games. I know, yeah, well, but, you know, he had a problem and he was, you know, the model of sort of professional calm and didn't sort of get on the mechanic's back about it. And Porte was very much the same, or at least the
you
bit
and I
we
would
saw.
Be like that in
oh,
that
I mean, could you imagine? Could you imagine the blood's pumping you 4 kilometres from the finish?
That vein on your forehead would literally be throbbing out of your.
It would be
skin.
It would be like when I miss lunch or dinner. It would be as bad as that.
A bit like your demeanour at the buffet today.
Yeah, no, there's nothing worse than missing the buffet. You know, well,
today's buffet was worth missing, though, wasn't it?
It was much better when you left. Because they brought back some pudding and stuff.
We missed the pudding, Richard. Well, you said I spoke to Richie Porte. I didn't really. There was a right old scrum round the BMC bus, and I shoved the microphone under his mouth. And I was really impressed with how calmly he was taking it. Let's listen to a little bit of what Richie Porte said after the stage.
I mean, it's disaster. I don't know what really you can do. I mean, just move on, I suppose. But I mean, we're going that fast in terms of the bike change, but it all just happened so quickly that by the time Burghardt got back to me, the bunch was gone anyhow. I mean, it's kind of like last year in the Giro, minus a 2-minute penalty, but it probably would have been quicker to take the 2-minute penalty than the wheel change that I got anyhow. You know, it's far from over yet. I mean, maybe in the third week, if we keep it all together, I might be able to go off after a stage two. At the end of the day, I guess we just pretend like it never happened and wait for the mountains to come.
So that was Richie Porte. And finally tonight, we want to sort of look at Mark Cavendish's day in yellow. We spoke to a few people at the start, Lionel, didn't we, who have been involved or are involved in Cavendish's career. Just to gauge what Saturday's stage win meant in the context of Cavendish's whole career. I mean, Francois, I don't know what you thought. It was a clean sprint, a fair sprint, where we've always thought that in that kind of circumstance, Kittel will always win. And yet, Cavendish kind of rolled back time, didn't he?
I might be wrong about it, but even before the start of the tour, I had the impression that Cavendish was much more relaxed than he had been for a very long time. I mean, his days with Quickstep was not as happy as it could have been. His days with Sky, oddly enough, were not as happy as they could have been. And he really looks happy to be, well, with Rancho, Aizel, you know. Aizel has got a very, very strong and good influence on him. And well, okay, he repeated as a motto his phrase about, you know, dimension data and ending 5,000 bikes to
the Quebec charity,
to kids. Yeah. But it didn't sound so entirely untrue. I mean, I really have the impression he feels he's coming to a stage in his career when he has nothing to prove. He's probably more relaxed, probably just happier in this team. And I think these little things matter. in the end, you know. And to me, his win was really, you know, impressive. There was no discussion at all about it. And I wouldn't be surprised if he won a sprint tomorrow again.
Well, Richard, as much as I want to delay Francois, I can't watch France's glorious victory over Iceland this evening. It should have been France versus England, of course, shouldn't it? Had England not been totally hopeless.
Scotland. It could have been Scotland versus Iceland.
Oh, let's not stray into the
Scotland. In an alternate universe.
Scotland.
Alternate universe. Well, I think we should probably wrap things up, shouldn't we? We'll be back. Kilometre Zero starts tomorrow. First episode is a day in the life of us on the race. We're trying to sort of explain what goes on from morning till, from the alarm going off till last thing at night. It's right like the Waltons, isn't it? At last thing at night. Night Lionel. But anyway, that's coming up tomorrow. Please subscribe to the Cycling Podcast on iTunes to guarantee that you get the podcast as soon as it's released. And if you feel like it, leave a review, a positive one, preferably. Leave a review on iTunes, I think that helps. But we're flying high in the iTunes chart. We're number one at the moment in the iTunes sports chart. So thank you very much, everybody who's listening. Thank you, Lionel.
Thank you very much, Richard.
And thank you, Francois, and hope you can join us again soon.
Merci, les gars, as we say in French.